Welcome. This is Dr. Philip E. Stieg, professor and chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University, and I'd like to welcome you to How to Save Your Life. This week, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Rasha Simmons, the Weisskopf Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology and the Medical Director of Clinical Research at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Dr. Simmons is a founding member of the American Society of Breast Surgeons with an international reputation for the management of breast cancer. Unfortunately, too many women and their husbands have experienced that sinking feeling when they notice a lump in their breast. What do you do about it? And is there hope? For the answer to these questions and more, please stay tuned to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Rasha Simmons, a world-renowned breast surgeon and an expert in the management of breast cancer. Dr. Simmons, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a common problem that has touched every one of our lives in terms of family, friends, workmates. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what is the prevalence? How common is breast cancer in our society?
Well, breast cancer is an incredibly common disease, and the numbers now are showing that about 1 in 8 of American women are going to be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime.
That's an incredibly high number. People are always going to start getting worried with a number like that. Who's at risk?
Well, most people assume that you're only at risk if you have a family history, but that's actually not true. About 80% of the women that were diagnosed with breast cancer do not have a family history. So you cannot assume that you're immune and that you will not develop this disease purely by the fact that you don't have a family history. Now, having said that, there are certain categories of women who are at a higher risk than average. And those women would be those that do have a strong history of either breast cancer or ovarian cancer in their families. Women, of course, that have already had breast cancer are at a higher risk of getting a second breast cancer as well. And there are some women that have had previous biopsies that show some pre-malignant or high-risk changes that would also put them in a very high-risk category someday developing breast cancer.
So 20% of the patients, there is a strong family history. Now, is that genetic? Is it environmental? What are the components that play a role in that familial form?
It's probably complex and perhaps a combination of all of those. But certainly when we see a family history where a mother, a grandmother, a maternal aunt had breast cancer, we begin to get concerned. Most women overestimate their risk of breast cancer. What I typically find is a patient will come to me and say, I'm at very high risk for breast cancer. I'll ask about her family history, and she'll say, oh yes, my grandmother had breast cancer at age 70. Well, that does not put you at a high risk for breast cancer. What we see in families where we start getting concerned are multiple family members with breast or ovarian cancer. If the patients have had breast cancer in both breasts, or if they were diagnosed at a very early age, specifically in their 40s or younger, that's when we start getting really concerned. There could indeed be a genetic predisposition to breast cancer.
So does everybody who you think there may be a familial predisposition undergo genetic testing, or is that selected for specific patients?
It's really selected for specific patients. I think it's worth bringing it up to a patient who has a very strong family history, but then the patient really needs to understand what's involved with genetic testing and what that would mean to her. The first thing is, what is the test? Well, the test is really very simple. It's a blood test, so it's not a big test to undergo. The blood is sent off to a central lab that's then processed to see if they indeed have a mutation for a breast cancer gene. Now, the real issue is what to do with that information. And all patients should be seen by a genetic counselor prior to being tested to make sure they really understand what does it mean to be positive, what does it mean to be negative, and then if you are positive, what are your options as far as treatment thereafter. Now, if a patient is tested and found to be positive for the breast cancer mutation, a BRCA1 or 2 mutation.
When you say BRCA1, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
We use that as our abbreviation. It actually, BRCA stands for breast cancer as an abbreviation, and there are two mutations, there are two main mutations that we can identify currently, and that's BRCA1 and BRCA2.
And these are mutations in their genetic structure of all their
cells.
That's
correct. So if you find that on this blood test, then what that's telling us is that this patient has about an 85% lifetime risk of developing breast cancer and somewhere around a 20 to 40% lifetime risk of developing ovarian cancer.
First of all, to dispel any fears, the test is just a mere blood test, so it's not very painful to undergo.
That's correct.
And when in science we talk about the sensitivity and specificity, perhaps you can explain that to the listeners in terms that we can all understand. I mean, just the test might not be sensitive enough to pick this up, or it may be overly sensitive. How does that work?
Sure. It's not overly sensitive. If you're positive, you're positive for the mutation. But again, to say you have an 85% lifetime risk, it's not 100% lifetime risk. So every single woman that has this mutation does not develop breast cancer. But she does have the opportunity to pass that mutation on to her, to her children. So that's why you can actually see skip generations within families. And maybe a grandmother has breast cancer, the granddaughter has breast cancer, but the mother doesn't. She would have had the mutation and passed it on, but not developed breast cancer. So we do see that occasionally. What I think is more important for patients to understand is that if the test is negative, that doesn't always mean very much. Sometimes patients assume that if the test is negative, that they're not going to get breast cancer. Well, that's absolutely not true, because all that's saying at the most is that they're not in that high-risk category. They could still be at the same risk as the average woman walking down the street to get breast cancer, like anybody could get breast cancer. So it doesn't eliminate the risk. It just doesn't put them in a high-risk category. Now, the other thing to understand about being negative is that often we'll see a family that has multiple relatives that have breast cancer, young ages, ovarian cancer, the classic family where we'd expect to see a mutation, and we test the members and they're negative. Well, what that means is probably there is a mutation that we just can't currently identify with the testing that we have available today. So a patient needs to understand that. The other thing we see sometimes is a patient may have a very strong family history, but all of her relatives are deceased. So to test that patient who does not currently have breast cancer and she's negative means one of two things. Either her family did have a mutation and she was lucky enough to not inherit the mutation, which puts her back to the average risk of the average woman, or number two, there is a mutation in her family that we can't identify, and therefore her test really is meaningless. We don't know her risk at that point for breast cancer.
So I'm sitting here listening to you and feeling my blood pressure actually go up a little bit in terms of the risk profile. All in all, it's 1 in 8. Now, if somebody has these positive tests, that throws them up to a 1 in what chance?
Well, 85% lifetime risk. So a very high risk of getting breast cancer.
Okay. And that's just the genetic component, meaning what may be transmitted from one family generation to the next. One of the frequent questions that I get from patients, you know, what did I do wrong? You know, did I do something? Are there any environmental factors or things that we as patients do that predispose us to developing breast cancer?
There are some very minor associations that have been shown with diet and also with exercise and with alcohol use, so that if a patient exercises, her risk may be lowered very slightly. If the patient drinks excessive alcohol, she may be increased in her risk slightly. Diet really has not panned out to be that important, and there's a lot of conflicting information about that. It was thought for a long time that a high-fat diet actually was associated with increased risk of breast cancer, but some of the later very sophisticated and well-done studies have not shown that to be the case. There certainly is an associated risk with colon cancer and heart disease, so any physician would tell their patients don't eat a high-fat diet, but as far as breast cancer, there does not seem to be an association whatsoever. There is an association with radiation risk, and not the kind of radiation that we're talking about from getting CT scans and that sort of thing. So I don't mean to frighten patients about any kind of imaging test. What we're talking about are patients such as those that were exposed to the bombings at the end of World War II in Japan. Those women were found to have a very high risk of subsequent breast cancer. What was particularly interesting about that is it was not the group of women that were in their 40s and 50s that were exposed. It was the group of women that were in puberty when they were exposed. And what that's telling us is that the timing of the exposure may be very important, that as the breast is developing in puberty, it may be more sensitive to environmental exposures than it is as an adult. That would actually have an effect upon your risk 20 or 30 years later. We see something very similar in patients that have had radiation treatment for lymphoma. They would have had radiation treatment to the chest that would include the breast area. Again, usually in puberty or their early 20s, when they were typically diagnosed with a lymphoma and treated with the radiation. Those patients are at an enormously increased risk of subsequent breast cancer and should be followed appropriately because of that risk. So what that turns out to say is if there is some sort of a dietary risk or some other sort of risk in our environment, it may very well be a risk that happens 20 or 30 years before the actual incident. And that's what makes it really difficult for us to go back and try to tease out What did a woman eat 20 or 30 years ago? Well, no one remembers what you ate 20 or 30 years ago. And that's very, very difficult to be able to correlate with a risk of breast cancer in the future.
We'll get into screening a little bit later, but that's why I wanted to kind of elucidate what the risk factors were, because I would presume the earlier you catch the disease, the better the outcome. So people are going to want to be monitored more closely if they've been exposed to a risk factor.
Right. Yeah, of course, the question that many patients ask who are in these very high-risk categories is, what can I do to decrease my risk of breast cancer? And you really fall into several options for those patients, the ones that are at this 85% lifetime risk. One option is that we know you're at high risk. We're going to follow you very, very carefully with imaging tests in the future and examinations. The other option is that there are two medications that have currently been proven to decrease one's risk of breast cancer. That's tamoxifen and raloxifen, or Avista is a different name for that medication. And those can be taken to decrease one's risk. Some patients actually make the decision to have a surgical prevention of their breast cancer. That would be having preventative mastectomies or preventative removal of their ovaries. And, of course, those are very effective at decreasing the risk, but there are emotional issues in making that decision. So it needs to be discussed at length with the patient and make sure she understands what the surgery would involve and make sure it's the right decision for her.
I noticed you didn't mention birth control pills. There used to be a lot of literature on that, and I'm certainly not up to date. And then I don't want to put you on the spot also, but the whole Dow thing with breast implants. What are the roles for those two factors?
We have not found any association with birth control pills and an increased risk of breast cancer. And that's having taken birth control pills for 20 years for these patients. So that does not seem to put them at an increased risk for breast cancer. And actually, there are good data to suggest that taking birth control pills, even for as little as 5 years, decreases the risk of ovarian cancer. So there could be an advantage in some women who are high risk of taking birth control pills purely to decrease the risk of ovarian cancer in the future. As far as implants go, there really is absolutely not a shred of evidence to say that implants are associated with an increased risk of breast cancer.
I know that breast cancer isn't a disease that's limited to women, and I wanted you to comment briefly on what is the frequency and the role of breast cancer in men?
Men do get breast cancer, and most men are not aware of that. About 1% of all breast cancer is male breast cancer. And it actually is a disease that stage for stage or at the point of diagnosis is equal for women, but often the diagnosis is delayed in men because they're not thinking about breast cancer, they're not examining themselves for breast cancer, they're not getting mammograms or ultrasounds, and often their physicians are not examining them for breast cancer. But what's important is that if a man notices a hard mass in his breast, he absolutely should be seen by a physician to make sure that it is not breast cancer. This is particularly true for men in their 50s or older. They really should not be developing hard masses in the breast. That should be evaluated to make sure that it's not a breast cancer and treated appropriately if it is.
Is a hard mass the only sign that they might
have? It's the most common sign. Typically, because the breast tissue in men is very small, you would feel a mass. And, of course, men aren't getting mammograms, so you wouldn't typically see an imaging change. They can have nipple discharge, especially bloody nipple discharge. They could have retraction of a nipple. Those would be the most common signs that we would see as far as a male breast cancer.
It's time to take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Rasha Simmons and how to avoid, treat, and survive breast cancer. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Rasha Simmons, a world-renowned breast surgeon and an expert in the management of breast cancer. Before the break, we had started talking briefly about breast cancer in men. And if a male is diagnosed, then it truly is breast cancer. Is the treatment the same and the prognosis the same?
It actually is very similar as far as the treatment as well as a prognosis. The only difference is that men are often diagnosed later than women because they're not aware of breast cancer, not having the kind of screening tests for breast cancer. Often their physicians are not examining them looking for breast cancer. So they often are diagnosed later. But if they are diagnosed at the same time as a woman, the prognosis is exactly the same. They're treated very similarly also. You treat with surgery and sometimes radiation therapy, but usually not. Men don't typically have lumpectomies because there'd be no point. There's so little breast tissue for a man, there'd really be no advantage in taking out a quarter of the breast mound that's the size of a quarter. So essentially taking out very little tissue for a man is a mastectomy. We would give chemotherapy the same way we would for women if it's appropriate. We would evaluate the lymph nodes in a man the same way that we would in a woman if appropriate. That's lymph nodes in the armpit area, which is where breast cancer would typically spread first. And interestingly, we often give men the drug tamoxifen that we would give women for breast cancer. And even though that's treating estrogen receptors, the men who do get breast cancer typically have estrogen receptors in their breast cancer and respond very well to tamoxifen.
I'm presuming that since it's a smaller number than in women, that there isn't the genetic component and you don't have any markers that, you know, men could go and get screened for this.
Actually, if a man tests positive for BRCA2, he is at a high risk of getting breast cancer. It's been shown that BRCA2 mutations are linked with male breast cancer. So,
is there a reason why a man would get that test?
It would really only be done if, let's say, a woman had breast cancer, a strong family history of breast cancer, and a woman who's tested positive has a son. Well, he might be tested just purely to know for his own children if he'd be passing on this mutation. But if he does test positive, he should be screened for breast cancer.
So, I mean, I don't want to all of a sudden have a flurry of men running off to, you know, their clinicians now and asking for this test. What advice do you give to the male members of females with a strong family history?
Well, generally we would test the females first because what Right. we typically do is test the patient that has breast cancer. So if the patient tests negative for the mutation, there's no reason to test her children or her siblings or her other cousins. If a woman tests positive for BRCA2, that it may be appropriate for her direct relatives to be tested as well for BRCA2. The other thing that's the reason it's important for men is that the BRCA2 mutation is not just associated with male breast cancer. It's also associated with increases of colon cancer, of prostate cancer. So there are other cancers that this man should be screened for as well if he tested BRCA2 positive.
Okay. We touched upon it a little bit earlier. But can we give the listeners some specific things that they can do to try to decrease their risk for developing breast cancer?
Well, for most women, the average woman, there's not much you can do to decrease your risk for breast cancer, honestly. If you are someone who is in a very high-risk category, for example, someone that has tested positive for one of these mutations, then the options would be very diligent screening, which would be mammograms, potentially ultrasounds, depending upon her age, perhaps MRI screening, examinations typically 2 to 4 times a year by a physician.
When do they start? So we'll assume now that somebody's got a strong family history and they're really worried about it. When should they really start talking to their doctor about getting the mammogram? And then when do you add these other tests like MRIs and ultrasound?
For the average woman, we start mammograms at age 40, once a year. Now, for a woman that has a strong family history, we would begin that 10 years younger than her youngest first-degree relative. So let's say a woman has a mother who had breast cancer at 45. Then we would start screening her at age 35. So it's whichever is younger, either 40 or 10 years younger than your youngest first-degree relative.
And that screening is done just with a mammogram?
Mammogram, potentially ultrasound. If the woman is young, let's say she's in her 20s or her 30s that we're screening for the breast cancer, mammograms are not as helpful in that age group. mammograms are much more effective as women get older. And the reason is because a woman's breast tissue is composed of a combination of fatty and fibrous tissue. That ratio changes as we get older. In young women, it's more fibrous tissue, less fatty tissue. As we get older, it becomes predominantly more fatty tissue. It's really easy to see cancers on fatty breast mammograms. So mammograms are much more effective as we get into our 40s and our 50s, and not terribly effective in our 20s and our 30s. So if we have a woman that we want to screen who's 25 years old, we may get mammograms, but with the knowledge that they may not be very effective in her screening process. So we would often add ultrasound to that. Ultrasound is a much better technique for screening young women for breast cancer. It sees through that dense fibrous tissue much better than mammograms can.
So, patients like to dictate their care a little bit, as they should. I'm really concerned then about getting the right information out there. You know, how sensitive is a mammogram? I mean, you know, if I'm a woman, I go in, I get my mammogram, and it's clean. Can I walk out of there thinking, whew, I dodged the bullet? Or, you know, is there another 20% chance that it was missed?
Well, mammograms are good. They're a very good test, probably one of the best tests that we have, and they're very effective at finding breast cancer. But it depends upon the density of one's breast tissue. If you have very dense breast tissue, which,
meaning that fibrous tissue?
That fibrous tissue, which typically is younger women, but it can also be older women on estrogen replacement therapy that have very dense breast tissue, or some women just maintain dense breast tissue into their 50s or 60s. If the radiologist says to you, you have very dense breast tissue, then I like to add an ultrasound for a screening test, no matter what the age of the woman. I think it increases the sensitivity of being able to find cancers.
So it's the uh-oh time, you know, it's self-examination, or you have the ultrasound or a mammogram and it shows a questionable lump. You know, what are the next steps, you know, other than panic? Where do you go and what should you make sure happens?
Well, it depends upon several things. The first thing that happens very often is a woman will have a mammogram and they'll see a little bit of a density. They may very well want to just get some more films. Often you can have overlying normal breast tissue that appears as a density on a mammogram. So often what happens, the patient will be called back for more films. Of course, she panics at this point thinking that she has breast cancer, but often it's just the film was blurry or they didn't get a really good picture of some area. They may want to do what's called magnification views, looking much more carefully at one spot on the mammogram. Or what's called a cone compression view, is pressing out an area extra hard. The reason they do that is that if you have overlying breast tissue, it can look like a mass, of course, on a mammogram. If you press really hard, it'll spread that tissue out, thin it out so you can see through it. Then we know it's not a cancer. If it doesn't spread out, then we have to be concerned that it might indeed be a cancer. So that's the first thing. Often they need to have more films. They may want to add an ultrasound to the regimen. That's fine. That all makes perfect sense. If after having had additional films or an ultrasound, there's a persistent abnormality, then sometimes the radiologist will say, our suspicion is very low. We see this and it's real, but the chance of it being a cancer is less than 5% or less than 1%. Does not really look very suspicious to us. If that's the case, they may very well ask a woman to come back in 6 months to repeat the mammogram. That happens very often as well. Now, the third category is when they say to you, we really are concerned about this. We think you need to have a biopsy done. So that's when the patient needs to talk to a breast surgeon about what biopsy options are available to her. There typically are two ways that we can do biopsies, one of which is called a needle biopsy. There are two options. One is a bigger needle called a core, and one is called a fine needle aspiration. They both work very well. My preference is a core biopsy because you get more information from that. This can be done on a mass that's felt in the breast by a simple office procedure. It takes 5 minutes to do. You numb the skin, put a little needle in, take out a strip of tissue that's then sent to our pathologist to make a diagnosis. If you cannot feel the mass, then the radiologist or the surgeon would target that needle biopsy by either ultrasound or mammography to be able to, again, take a little strip of tissue out, send it off to our pathologist. Sometimes patients either don't want to have that done or are not a really good candidate to have that done. Sometimes the lesion that we're seeing is either very, very close to the muscle on the chest wall, very close to the skin, or in an area that we really can't access well by doing a needle biopsy. And in that case, the patient would need to have a surgical removal of the lesion. Sometimes patients prefer to have a surgical removal of the lesion. The accuracy of a needle biopsy is 95%+. But some patients say to me, I want 100% accuracy, and I don't want to wait 6 months for a follow-up. I absolutely want to make sure that I don't have cancer. I can't sleep at night unless I know I don't have cancer. If that's the case, we can always do a surgical biopsy, remove the area, and have 100% accurate information. So a surgical biopsy is typically a very straightforward operation done as an outpatient surgery. The operation typically is about a half an hour long and often done under a combination of what we call sedation and local anesthesia. What that means is the patient would have an IV put in when she comes into the operating room. And she would typically get some medicine very much like Valium. She'd get very relaxed and very sleepy. There would not be a breathing tube put in. She'd take a little nap for half an hour. We do the procedure. She wakes up, goes to recovery, and is on her way home. And we'd have an answer in a couple of days as far as the results.
This kind of leads me to a little bit more of a difficult question. You know, not everybody's fortunate enough to get access to you. Where does one go for all of this? I mean, is it important? Can you just go to any general surgeon, to your internist? Is it better to go to a breast cancer center right away? What advice do you have for the patient?
Well, my advice to a patient is you want to go to someone who does this a lot. Now, that can be a general surgeon if they do a lot of breast work. That can also, of course, be a breast surgeon. And certainly in a metropolitan area, most patients would have the luxury of being able to go to someone who does only breast surgery. And that person would be qualified to do this. If you're in a more rural area and you would have a general surgeon who does a lot of breast work, that should be fine. If the person doesn't do a lot of breast work, I think you should seek out someone who does, because I think you'll get better treatment that way.
You were talking a little bit about, you know, the different types of needle biopsies, where obviously you stick a needle into the abnormal tissue. Is there any trouble that you can stir up by doing that? And, you know, should you not do a needle biopsy at some point?
That's a very commonly asked question. And, of course, the concern is if you go in, you pierce the cancer, are you going to spread those cells around? Are you going to cause the cancer to spread? And the answer is no, that you don't. It's a theoretical concern, but it's never been shown to be accurate. So it's not a realistic concern.
Great. You kind of touched upon it a little bit earlier about, you know, the getting to a surgery. I wanted you to touch upon just the differences between, you know, the concept of a lumpectomy versus a modified radical mastectomy. These are big words, and radical mastectomy. I mean, what do they mean, number one, and what's the difference, and, you know, how do you inform a patient that they're the candidate for that specific therapy?
Well, most patients today, because of good screening, they were able to find breast cancers early when they're still small, are candidates to have a lumpectomy. And a lumpectomy means removing the lesion. The name implies there really is a lump. There often actually isn't a lump. It may be just calcifications in the breast or an area that you can't feel, but we use the same term, lumpectomy. Also, terms that are used that I don't like, that I think scare patients, are a partial mastectomy, which really is the same thing as a lumpectomy. It sounds like a lot more surgery, but it really isn't. Or tilectomy, quadrantectomy, they're all the same thing. But most of us today use the term lumpectomy. So that is a simple removal of a cancerous area. Now, some patients are diagnosed either with a larger cancer or would prefer, for various reasons, to have a mastectomy. What that means is removing the entire breast. We don't do it that often today. Probably 25-30% of patients would have a mastectomy. We do it sometimes preventatively, as I alluded to before. Sometimes patients come to us and have a very high risk of breast cancer and want to prevent breast cancer in the future, or may have a diagnosis of breast cancer and say, I never want to see breast cancer ever again, and I don't want to wear my other breast ever again. And those patients, they may prefer to have one or both breasts removed surgically to prevent having breast cancer in the future.
It sounds like a lot of this is patient-driven. I mean, are there studies that support all of this? Or
some of it is. As far as the prognosis for a patient that has a small breast cancer that's amenable to lumpectomy, the patient has lumpectomy plus radiation therapy. It's a package, lumpectomy plus radiation. It's been shown to be equal in survival to mastectomy. Now, what isn't the same is having a new independent breast cancer come back 5, 10, 20 years later, but that risk is very, very small. So most patients, given the choice between lumpectomy versus mastectomy, would choose lumpectomy for the obvious reasons of less surgery and being able to maintain their breast. But there are some patients that prefer to have a mastectomy. And if that's the case, then certainly that can be done, and certainly it will treat the problem of their breast cancer.
Now, if a person opts to have the lumpectomy, are they also then choosing at the same time, does the surgeon get some biopsies of the lymph nodes as well to make sure? What are the indications for that?
Whether one has a lumpectomy or a mastectomy, we want to know the status of the lymph nodes in the armpit area. The reason is the lymph nodes act as a screen between the breast cancer and the rest of the body. So if we remove or test the lymph nodes and they're clean, that's a very good sign that cancer has not broken off and gone to the lymph nodes and beyond the lymph nodes. And for that reason, we would not give chemotherapy. If the patient, though, has lymph nodes that do show cancer, then we have to be concerned. The lymph nodes may have just caught the cancer and it went no further, but we have to also suspect there could have been cells that broke off and went to the rest of the body. So certainly if a patient has positive lymph nodes, we want to give the patient chemotherapy. Now, there is a newish way of testing lymph nodes called a sentinel lymph node biopsy. That's been around about 10 years. So most places in the country are currently doing sentinel lymph node biopsies for breast cancer patients.
So what do you mean by sentinel lymph node?
What it is it allows us to target the one or two lymph nodes, the most likely ones to have cancer cells in them if any of them do. So we remove those one or two lymph nodes on the day of their lumpectomy or mastectomy. Those are tested by the pathologist. If they are clean, all the other lymph nodes are going to be clean as well, and there's no reason to take out other additional clean lymph nodes. If those lymph nodes do show cancer, then there's about a 50% chance there are other lymph nodes that do as well, and there's no way to pick and choose which ones do or don't have cancer in the armpit area. And, of course, you don't want to leave cancer behind. So if we do find the pathology report shows that there is cancer in the lymph nodes, then we remove all the lymph nodes in the armpit area, called an axillary dissection.
So, like some other cancers, there are tests that you can do, say a PET scan, to determine whether there's disease elsewhere in the body. Can you do any tests like that before with breast cancer to see whether the lymph nodes light up and you know where to go?
Not for the lymph nodes. There really aren't any accurate tests that tell us if the lymph nodes are involved or not. There are tests we can look for spread to the rest of the body, such as bone scans and CT scans, but they are not accurate at predicting involvement of the lymph nodes.
So I'm a little bit unclear still. It seems to me if I were the patient, I'd want to have a lumpectomy. But what provokes you, the surgeon, to push a patient to have either a more aggressive surgery, mastectomy or modified?
A lot of it depends upon the size of the cancer compared to the size of the breast. So if a patient has a very small cancer, then she's a wonderful candidate to have a lumpectomy. If a patient has a very large cancer, especially in a small breast, well, you're not going to be able to resect that and have any kind of a reasonable cosmetic result. So I explain to patients, if we have to take a third or a half of your breast to be able to remove your cancer, you would look much better from a cosmetic standpoint to have a mastectomy and a good breast reconstruction than you would to remove that much breast tissue and radiate it. You'd have a significant cosmetic defect afterwards.
Great. Well, you touched a little bit upon one of the concepts I wanted to get into, the thought about when to reconstruct. Do we do it at the time of surgery or later? And we'll do that after we take a short break. Don't go anywhere. We'll have more with Dr. Rasha Simmons and how to avoid, treat, and survive breast cancer. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and you are listening to How to Save Your Life. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and I'm talking with Dr. Rasha Simmons, a world-renowned breast surgeon and an expert in the management of breast cancer. Before the break, we were speaking briefly about the various operations for breast cancer and then touched upon the concept of what we call reconstruction. Can you explain to the listeners what we mean by reconstruction and when that should be done, if it should be done?
Sure. We're talking about as a patient that would have a mastectomy, have a removal of her breast surgically. And then reconstruction would be replacing the breast in some fashion. It is absolutely true that the vast majority of patients should be offered breast reconstruction and should be offered at the time of their mastectomy. Now, there are a few exceptions to that, but in general, patients should be offered to go to sleep with the breast and to wake up with the breast. And it certainly is so much better for the patient to do it that way. Emotionally, they do so much better to understand they're going to have a reconstruction than to have a mastectomy without reconstruction. Also, to do it in one operation versus doing it in two operations, why would any patient want to go through two general anesthesias, two recoveries? It just doesn't make any sense. Also, we as a team of breast surgeons and plastic surgeons can do a much better job from a cosmetic standpoint to reconstruct the breast at the time of the mastectomy than going back and trying to do it 6 months or a year or later. So it really is best to be able to do it all at the same time.
And that is independent, again, when you're talking about whether you would do a mastectomy, you're talking about, I presume, a larger tumor in relation to a smaller breast. So it's independent of the person's anatomy. There's nothing that like that that plays a role in it.
Not so much in choosing to have immediate reconstruction. There is as far as which type of reconstruction one would have. There are two main ways that plastic surgeons do breast reconstruction. One is an implant. That can be either a saline implant or a silicone implant. What typically is done is at the time of the surgery, a tissue expander is put in. What that means is a deflated bag put underneath the muscle, underneath where the breast used to be, and that is inflated usually over the course of several weeks or several months to make that pocket the size to accommodate the permanent implant and to match the opposite side. So that's one option. The other option is to do what's called a TRAM flap, T-R-A-M. What that essentially is doing the same operation as a tummy tuck, removing that extra tissue that most women have in their lower abdomen, but instead of discarding the tissue, moving it up and making a new breast out of it. So that's a very nice option for many women. They get a tummy tuck at the same time as getting a breast reconstruction. They like that. Now, that very much depends upon the woman's anatomy, though. She has to have enough extra fatty tissue in the lower abdomen to be able to make a breast to match her opposite side. If it is smaller, the other option that plastic surgeons can do is reduce the normal breast to match. That can be done. So there are a lot of ways that plastic surgeons can work with the woman and her anatomy to give her a beautiful, symmetrical cosmetic result of a reconstruction.
That's great. I certainly want to leave the listeners with the sense of hope. Is there hope after being diagnosed with breast cancer?
There's always hope. And what I find so exciting about the field of breast cancer is how fast it's changing and how much it's getting better every year. I don't treat patients today the way I treated them 5 years ago, and even not the way I treated them 2 years ago. It's changing so, so quickly. And there are so many new treatments. For example, the one that I mentioned earlier as far as sampling the one or two lymph nodes instead of taking out all the lymph nodes in the armpit area. That's within the past 10 years. We're looking now at ways to not radiate the entire breast, but radiate only the area of the breast that has the cancer, called localized radiation therapy. And instead of having 30 days of radiation with the old way we used to do it, we can often do it in 5 days. So it's much better for the patient. So there's a rapidly changing field in breast cancer, and it's getting better every single year.
There was this device, I can't remember the name of it, but where, you know, at the time of a lumpectomy, you could actually put the radiation probe into the cavity. It was popularized in England and do direct radiation. Is that the new hot thing? Or?
It's experimental right now. It's being evaluated, and it may be a wonderful way to treat breast cancer patients, but right now it really is more experimental.
What you're describing then is certainly the surgical resection, but then it would a patient would typically now, what they should expect from their doctor is surgical removal And then what are the next steps that they should make sure that they're exposed to?
Sure. The first question is removing the breast cancer. That would either be through a lumpectomy or, if needed, a mastectomy. If you have a lumpectomy, you generally get radiation of some sort, and that often can be the localized radiation that we can offer the patients today. If one has an invasive breast cancer, then we need to evaluate the lymph nodes in the armpit area, typically today by a sentinel lymph node biopsy. Of the patients that are diagnosed today, about 80% of them will have clean lymph nodes and need to go no further beyond the sentinel lymph node biopsy. As far as systemic treatment, the options of chemotherapy versus hormonal therapy, whether those be recommended really depends upon the status of the lymph nodes and how large one's cancer is. If we think that it's justified to give you some sort of systemic therapy, then we would decide if it should be hormonal alone or hormonal combined with chemotherapy. The chemotherapy drugs have also improved dramatically in the past 10 years. What we're able to do today is really specify details about the patient's cancer and direct the chemotherapy to that particular kind of cancer. So instead of a shotgun, it's more of a bullet to be able to have much less side effects and much more effective drugs at targeting her specific cancer and specifically what it needs as far as chemotherapy.
So is this chemotherapy or is it immunotherapy?
Well, at this point, there's not a lot available outside of experimentation with immunotherapy for breast cancer. But we're looking at some of those as options to be able to potentially give vaccines, auto vaccines. There's a lot of exciting information coming in the near future about vaccines.
So you're also saying that the chemotherapeutic agents that they use, and when we refer to systemic, I presume it's given IV?
Most of them are. There are some that are given by pill, but most of them are IV.
They're well-tolerated, not a lot of weight loss. You don't feel terrible, throwing up, diarrhea.
Depends upon the drug and depends upon the individual. And what I tell patients, there's a spectrum of chemotherapy from very mild to very aggressive. And depending upon her prognosis, we put her where she needs to be in that spectrum. If we don't need to be very aggressive or we're doing it very just precautiously with her, then she wouldn't get very aggressive chemotherapy. If, however, she's someone that we're really worried about may develop systemic disease in the future, then she should appropriately get more aggressive chemotherapy. And, of course, the more aggressive, the more side effect we typically would see with a regimen.
Yeah. So that's the standard. Surgery, radiation, plus minus chemotherapy, and that's kind of tailored nowadays. I go through all that. How do you break it down in terms of what's my 5, 10, 15-year survival with this disease?
Well, it really depends upon the information we get at the time of your surgery. And a lot of that depends upon what size is your tumor, how aggressive are the cells of your tumor, do you have lymph nodes that are involved or do you not? And then as far as if we get further scans, if you do have evidence of disease elsewhere in the body, then we're more concerned that you're going to have a poor prognosis.
So where's this going? You just said a minute or two earlier that you don't practice medicine the same way you did 2 years ago. What do you see down the pike? What's going to be the bigger ray of hope?
Well, what's going to be happening is we already have been going, and we're certainly going in the future, towards more minimally invasive techniques of treating breast cancer. And what I envision, maybe as early as 5, but certainly I'd say within the next 10 years from now, is that a patient will come in with a new diagnosis of breast cancer, probably found even earlier than we can find it today because the imaging screen tests will be better than they are today. So you have a woman who comes in with a very small breast cancer. We will then do a needle biopsy. And with that needle biopsy, we'll be able to have a lot more information than we can today. We'll be able to tell, number one, how likely is it that she's going to have involvement of her lymph nodes? If that is not very likely, there's no reason to even go into a sentinel lymph node biopsy. So we're anticipating in many women probably 80 to 90% no surgery in the axilla at all. Number two, we'll be able to tell how likely is it that it will spread to the rest of the body, which will probably eliminate the need for all these scans that we get today. And then thirdly, we'll be able to tell which chemotherapy specifically is going to treat that breast cancer. So we'll be able to get all of that from a 5-minute procedure in the office. Then, as far as the treatment of the breast cancer, there's an area that is actually one of my areas of research where we're looking at options to ablate breast cancer. Now, what that means is being able to put a small probe, smaller than a pencil, into the breast the tip of that probe will get very, very cold and will actually freeze the breast cancer. And by doing that, it will be equal to having done a lumpectomy for the patient. So we're talking about doing a core biopsy, 5 minutes in the office, then another 20-minute office procedure where you put the probe in, freeze the breast cancer, probably not even do radiation at that point, and then the patient may need some sort of systemic treatment beyond that, and that's it. So the cosmetic result will be excellent because we haven't done any surgery on the breast. We haven't removed any breast tissue, and the patient's prognosis will also be excellent in having minimally invasive treatment.
So with all of this, have you ever seen a miracle? Any complete surprise, somebody that survived?
Of course. Yeah. It's one of the reasons I love what I do, because you do see patients who do really well that you thought might not have done well. And science doesn't always predict who's going to do well and not do well. And I've had patients who have 15, 20 positive nodes that are doing beautifully 10 years later. For example, one patient who was diagnosed with 20 positive lymph nodes, had her treatment, had her chemotherapy, and then actually in the midst of her chemotherapy, got married and is living a wonderful life. She says, what's interesting, a lot of patients have said this very same thing to me, that having been diagnosed with breast cancer was the best thing that ever happened to her. And you look at her and you think, why could that possibly be? And she says, I see life so totally differently now than I ever did before. She said, I appreciate every single day, and I never did before, and that I'm a better person now, having had breast cancer and living my life accordingly.
Do you think there's a personality difference in patients, you know, given two patients with the same disease? Is there a personality you think that is inherently going to do better?
There's no scientific data to say that. Although those of us who do breast cancer all day, every day, we do think that the patients who have a more optimistic attitude do better.
I can't think of a disease that evokes more emotion from everybody, from the patient, from the family. It becomes a family experience when this occurs. What attracted you to going into this? You said earlier, the hope is why you go into this and, you know, the miracles. What is it that you feel?
Well, it's two things. I love the fact that it's constantly changing for the better for the patients. And I love being involved in that change and being able to see patients having less invasive treatment 1 year versus 5 years ago. I think that's very exciting. You can never be bored in this field because every single patient is different and every single treatment is catered to that particular patient. The other reason I like breast cancer surgery compared to many other areas of surgery is that in many areas, you'd see a patient, for example, take out her appendix, see her as a postoperative visit, and probably never see her again. In breast cancer, you see your patients forever, and it's almost like being a family practitioner. You develop real relationships with your patients, and because of the fact that many of the patients have relatives that have breast cancer, you meet their families as patients or not, but often as patients. And so you really get to know the family, and they send you, you know, announcements when their babies are born. They send you wedding invitations for their children. It's really lovely. It's a wonderful way to practice medicine.
Do you think that medical school and medicine is changing? Do you think that with the population of women that are getting into medical school and pursuing medicine as an occupation, do you find that, or do you think that in your experiences during your training, do you see the patients relating to you differently than they do to a male surgeon?
Patients do say that to me. They say they appreciate having a woman as their breast surgeon, and I'm sure there are many male breast surgeons who are wonderful at what they do, and I don't mean to any way discredit male breast surgeons. The women say that they can relate because they understand that how I would relate to that situation. And, you know, for example, often the residents will ask me, well, why are you making an incision way down there? It's a lot more trouble to make an incision there versus 4 inches from there. And I say, because she's going to really care when she's 10 years out from her cancer and doing well, that when she wears an evening dress, she doesn't see her incision. So if you can make the incision somewhere they're not going to see them, they really appreciate that.
So relate for us a little bit just the process of going to medical school. I presume you did a surgical residency, you did an oncology fellowship. Now you're a highly acclaimed breast surgeon. how you manage all that and do family. What should young women look forward to in the field of medicine?
Well, I think breast cancer is a great area for men or women. Surgery is a great area. And I would tell anyone, but I tell the medical students today when they ask me what they should go into, you should go into what you love, because you're going to do it an awful lot of hours during the week and during the day. And you want to look forward to going to work every day. You want to really enjoy what you do. So you have to find what that niche is. You have to find what it is that just really makes you interested and makes you happy. And for me, it was breast cancer, because it's evolving, because all the patients are different, because it's a way to do research and also have a wonderful relationship with your patients. It's been a wonderful career and continues to be and will continue to be.
So when you wake up in the morning and you know you're going to go face somebody that's dying of breast cancer, what keeps you going?
Well, you have those patients. And, you know, I think that what we have to appreciate is that we're not God, and we do what we can. And we're not always successful, but we do the very best that we can to give them the best prognosis. But fortunately, in breast cancer, most patients do really well. So it's not like some other areas of cancer surgery where the majority of your patients die. It's the minority, the vast minority of our patients that die. Most of them do very well, and I think we're going to see patients do better and better in the future.
Well, it's been a distinct pleasure to have Dr. Rasha Simmons, the Weisskopf Associate Professor of Surgical Oncology and the Medical Director of Clinical Research at Weill Medical College of Cornell University, speaking to us about breast cancer and providing hope, as I would see it, for people that are diagnosed with this, and also outlining specific treatment pathways and paradigms that the patient can follow. Again, Dr. Simmons, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.